Chapter 28. More competent candidate. Her presence in the house has previously brought down the pride and broken the heart of Appel's poor old mother, and her life is a failure. Death comes for her, but is willing to trade her for the Roman girl, so the bargain is struck with Appel's, and the mother is spared for the present. No one's life escapes the blight. Timolus, the gay satirist of the first two acts, who scoffed at the pious hypocrisies and money-grubbing ways of the great Roman lords, is grown old, and fat and blear-eyed and racked with disease in the third, has lost his stately purities, and watered the acid of his wit. His life has suffered defeat. Unthinkingly he swears by Zeus from ancient habit and then quakes with fright, for a fellow communicant is passing by. Reproached by a pagan friend of his youth for his apostasy, he confesses that principle, when unsupported by an assenting stomach, has to climb down. One must have bread, and the bread is Christian now. Then the poor old wreck, once so proud of his iron rectitude, hobbles away, coughing and barking. In that same act Appel's, give his sweet young Christian daughter and her fine young pagan lover his consent and blessing, and makes them utterly happy for 5 minutes. Then the priest and the mob come, to tear them apart and put the girl in a nunnery, for marriage between the sexes forbidden. Appel's wife could dissolve the rule, and she wants to do it, but under priestly pressure she wavers. Then, fearing that in providing happiness for her child she would be committing a sin dangerous to her own, she goes over to the opposition, and throws the casting vote for the nunnery. The blight has fallen upon the young couple, and their life is a failure. In the fourth act, Longinus, who made such a prosperous and enviable start in the first act, is left alone in the desert, sick, blind, helpless, incredibly old, to die. Not a friend left in the world, another ruined life. And in that act, also, Appel's worshipped boy, Nymphas, done to death by the mob, breathes out his last sigh in his father's arms, one more failure. In the fifth act, Appel's himself dies, and is glad to do it. He who so ignorantly rejoiced, only 4 acts before, over the splendid present of an earthly immortality, the very worst failure of the lot. 2. Now I approach my project. Here is the theater list for Saturday, May 7, 1898, cut from the advertising columns of a New York paper. Graphic here, now I arrive at my project, and make my suggestion. From the look of this lightsome feast, I conclude that what you need is a tonic. Send for the master of Palmyra. You are trying to make yourself believe that life is a comedy, that its sole business is fun, that there is nothing serious in it. You are ignoring the skeleton in your closet. Send for the master of Palmyra. You are neglecting a valuable side of your life. Presently it will be atrophied. You are eating too much mental sugar. You will bring on Bright's disease of the intellect. You need a tonic. You need it very much. Send for the master of Palmyra. You will not need to translate it. Its story is as plain as a procession of pictures. I have made my suggestion. Now I wish to put an annex to it. And that is this. It is right and wholesome to have those light comedies and entertaining shows, and I shouldn't wish to see them diminished. But none of us is always in the comedy spirit. We have our graver moods. They come to us all. The lightest of us cannot escape them. These moods have their appetites, healthy and legitimate appetites, and there ought to be some way of satisfying them. It seems to me that New York ought to have one theater devoted to tragedy. With her 3 millions of population, and 70 outside millions to draw upon, she can afford it, she can support it. America devotes more time, labor, money and attention to distributing literary and musical culture among the general public than does any other nation, perhaps. Yet here you find her neglecting what is possibly the most effective of all the breeders and nurses and disseminators of high literary taste and lofty emotion, the tragic stage. to leave that powerful agency out is to haul the culture wagon with a crippled team. Nowadays, when a mood comes which only Shakespeare can set to music, what must we do? Read Shakespeare ourselves. Isn't it pitiful? It is playing an organ solo on a Jew's harp. We can't read. None but the Booths can do it. 30 years ago, Edwin Booth played Hamlet 100 nights in New York. With 3 times the population, how often is Hamlet played now in a year? If Booth were back now in his prime, how often could he play it in New York? Some will say 25 nights. I will say 300, and say it with confidence. The tragedians are dead, but I think that the taste and intelligence which made their market are not. What has come over us English-speaking people? During the first half of this century, tragedies and great tragedians were as common with us as farce and comedy, and it was the same in England. Now we have not a tragedian, I believe, and London, with her 50 shows and theaters, has but 3, I think. It is an astonishing thing, when you come to consider it. Vienna remains upon the ancient basis. There has been no change. She sticks to the former proportions. A number of rollicking comedies, admirably played, every night, and also every night at the Burg Theater, that wonder of the world for grace and beauty and richness and splendor and costliness, a majestic drama of depth and seriousness, or a standard old tragedy. It is only within the last dozen years that men have learned to do miracles on the stage in the way of grand and enchanting scenic effects. And it is at such a time as this that we have reduced our scenery mainly to different breeds of parlors and varying aspects of furniture and rugs. I think we must have a Burg in New York, and Burg scenery, and a great company like the Burg Company. Then, with a tragedy tonic once or twice a month, we shall enjoy the comedies all the better. Comedy keeps the heart sweet. But we all know that there is wholesome refreshment for both mind and heart in an occasional climb among the solemn pomps of the intellectual snow summits built by Shakespeare and those others. Do I seem to be preaching? It is out of my life. I only do it because the rest of the clergy seem to be on vacation. Traveling with a reformer, last spring I went out to Chicago to see the fair, and although I did not see it, my trip was not wholly lost. There were compensations. In New York I was introduced to a major in the regular army who said he was going to the fair, and we agreed to go together. I had to go to Boston first, but that did not interfere. He said he would go along and put in the time. He was a handsome man and built like a gladiator. But his ways were gentle, and his speech was soft and persuasive. He was companionable, but exceedingly reposeful. Yes, and wholly destitute of the sense of humor. He was full of interest in everything that went on around him, but his serenity was indestructible. Nothing disturbed him, nothing excited him. But before the day was done, I found that deep down in him somewhere he had a passion. Quiet as he was, a passion for reforming petty public abuses. He stood for citizenship, it was his hobby. His idea was that every citizen of the Republic ought to consider himself an unofficial policeman, and keep unsalaried watch and ward over the laws and their execution. He thought that the only effective way of preserving and protecting public rights was for each citizen to do his share in preventing or punishing such infringements of them as came under his personal notice. It was a good scheme, but I thought it would keep a body in trouble all the time. It seemed to me that one would be always trying to get offending little officials discharged, and perhaps getting laughed at for all reward. But he said no, I had the wrong idea. That there was no occasion to get anybody discharged. That in fact you mustn't get anybody discharged, that would itself be a failure. No, one must reform the man, reform him, and make him useful where he was. Must one report the offender, and then beg his superior not to discharge him, but reprimand him and keep him? No, that is not the idea. You don't report him at all, for then you risk his bread and butter. You can act as if you are going to report him when nothing else will answer. But that's an extreme case. That is a sort of force, and force is bad. Diplomacy is the effective thing. Now if a man has tact, if a man will exercise diplomacy apostrophe, for 2 minutes we had been standing at a telegraph wicket, and during all this time the major had been trying to get the attention of one of the young operators, but they were all busy skylarking. The major spoke now, and asked one of them to take his telegram. He got 4 reply. I reckon you can wait a minute, can't you? Apostrophe apostrophe and the skylarking went on. The major said yes, he was not in a hurry. Then he wrote another telegram. President Western Union Tel Company, : come and dine with me this evening. I can tell you how business is conducted in one of your branches. Apostrophe apostrophe, presently the young fellow who had spoken so pertly a little before reached out, and took the telegram, and when he read it, he lost color, and began to apologize and explain. He said he would lose his place, if this deadly telegram was sent, and he might never get another. If he could be let off this time he would give no cause of complaint again. The compromise was accepted. As we walked away, the major said, now, you see, that was diplomacy and you see how it worked. It wouldn't do any good to bluster, the way people are always doing. That boy can always give you as good as you send, and you'll come out defeated and ashamed of yourself pretty nearly always. But you see, he stands no chance against diplomacy. Gentle words and diplomacy, those are the tools to work with. Apostrophe apostrophe, yes, I see. But everybody wouldn't have had your opportunity. It isn't everybody that is on those familiar terms with the President of the Western Union. Apostrophe apostrophe, oh, you misunderstand. I don't know the President, I only use him diplomatically. It is for his good and for the public good. There's no harm in it. Apostrophe apostrophe, I said with hesitation and diffidence. But is it ever right or noble to tell a lie? Apostrophe apostrophe, he took no note of the delicate self-righteousness of the question, but answered with undisturbed gravity and simplicity. Yes, sometimes. Lies told to injure a person, and lies told to profit yourself are not justifiable, but lies told to help another person, and lies told in the public interest, oh, well, that is quite another matter. Anybody knows that. But never mind about the methods. You see the result. That youth is going to be useful now, and well behaved. He had a good face. He was worth saving. Why, he was worth saving on his mother's account, if not his own. Of course, he has a mother, sisters too. Damn these people who are always forgetting that. Do you know, I've never fought a duel in my life, never once, and yet have been challenged, like other people. I could always see the other man's unoffending women folks, or his little children standing between him and me. They hadn't done anything, I couldn't break their hearts, you know. Apostrophe, he corrected a good many little abuses in the course of the day, and always without friction, always with a fine and dainty diplomacy which left no sting behind. And he got such happiness and such contentment out of these performances, that I was obliged to envy him his trade, and perhaps would have adopted it, if I could have managed the necessary deflections from fact as confidently with my mouth as I believe I could with a pen, behind the shelter of print, after a little practice. Away late that night we were coming uptown in a horse car, when 3 boisterous roughs got aboard, and began to fling hilarious obscenities and profanities right and left among the timid passengers, some of whom were women and children. Nobody resisted or retorted. The conductor tried soothing words and moral suasion, but the toughs only called him names and laughed at him. Very soon I saw that the major realized that this was a matter which was in his line. Evidently he was turning over his stock of diplomacy in his mind and getting ready. I felt that the first diplomatic remark he made in this place would bring down a landslide of ridicule upon him, and maybe something worse. But before I could whisper to him and check him, he had begun, and it was too late. He said, in a level and dispassionate tone, "Conductor, you must put these swine out. I will help you." Apostrophe, I was not looking for that. In a flash, the three roughs plunged at him. But none of them arrived. He delivered three such blows as one could not expect to encounter outside the prize ring, and neither of the men had life enough left in him to get up from where he fell. The major dragged them out and threw them off the car, and we got underway again. I was astonished. Astonished to see a lamb act so. Astonished at the strength displayed, and the clean and comprehensive result. Astonished at the brisk and business-like style of the whole thing. The situation had a humorous side to it, considering how much I had been hearing about mild persuasion and gentle diplomacy all day from this pile driver, and I would have liked to call his attention to that feature and do some sarcasms about it. But when I looked at him, I saw that it would be of no use. His placid and contented face had no ray of humor in it. He would not have understood. When we left the car, I said, "That was a good stroke of diplomacy, three good strokes of diplomacy, in fact." Apostrophe, apostrophe, that wasn't diplomacy. You are quite in the wrong. Diplomacy is a wholly different thing. One cannot apply it to that sort. They would not understand it. No, that was not diplomacy. It was force. Apostrophe, now that you mention it, I think perhaps you are right. Apostrophe, apostrophe, right? Of course I am right. It was just force. Apostrophe, I think, myself, it had the outside aspect of it. Do you often have to reform people in that way? Apostrophe, apostrophe, far from it. It hardly ever happens. Not oftener than once in half a year, at the outside. Apostrophe, apostrophe, those men will get well? Apostrophe, apostrophe, get well? Why, certainly they will. They are not in any danger. I know how to hit, and where to hit. You noticed that I did not hit them under the jaw. That would have killed them. Apostrophe, I believed that. I remarked rather wittily, as I thought that he had been a lamb all day, but now had all of a sudden developed into a ram battering ram. But with dulcet frankness and simplicity he said no, a battering ram was quite a different thing, and not in use now. This was maddening, and I came near bursting out and saying he had no more appreciation of wit than a jackass. In fact, I had it right on my tongue, but did not say it, knowing there was no hurry, and I could say it just as well some other time over the telephone. We started to Boston the next afternoon. The smoking compartment in the parlor car was full, and he went into the regular smoker. Across the aisle in the front seat sat a meek, farmer-looking old man with a sickly pallor in his face, and he was holding the door open with his foot to get the air. Presently a big brakeman came rushing through, and when he got to the door he stopped, gave the farmer an ugly scowl, then wrenched the door to with such energy as to almost snatch the old man's boot off. Then on he plunged about his business. Several passengers laughed, and the old gentleman looked pathetically shamed and grieved. After a little the conductor passed along, and the major stopped him, and asked him a question in his habitually courteous way. "Conductor, where does one report the misconduct of a brakeman? Does one report to you?" Apostrophe. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.